Yeah, yeah.
I must just be an old head because I do like Common. But anyway. So here we go. We are about to have a really serious conversation, a good conversation about these 12 months of Pope Francis, 266 popes after St. Peter in place. Some people are looking at Pope Francis as the reincarnation of Pope John XXIII, who gave us Vatican II. But both liberal and conservative Catholics are kind of claiming much of what he's done. He has done things like, as we'll talk about, one of the first things he did was bring liberation theologists back as soon as he became pope. However, when he was cardinal, he was part of the group that opposed liberation theology in Argentina. He has done things like saying we have more important things, we'll do the exact quote later, than just always talking about abortion and gay rights, and that we need to move on and just talk about the poor. He has kept in place many things that that people think are maybe liberal Catholics have opposed. But we'll go through all of these one by one and talk about what this legacy means with our really very interesting panel. Rosemary Thompson's in studio. This is executive director of the P. Francis Murphy Initiative for Justice and Peace, and been an activist in our community for a long time in the Catholic world and more. Good to have you back in the studio, Rosemary.
Thanks, Mark.
Ralph Moore, who's also been very active in the Catholic Church in this community, a community activist, worked in Catholic education for a good part of his life, coordinator of mentoring for the Adult Resource Center of the Living Classrooms Foundation, where he works with adult male ex-offenders. Ralph, good to have you back in the studio again. It's been a long time.
Yeah, good to be here.
Thank you. Back.
Thank you.
Monsignor Stuart Sweatland is back with us. He's vice president of Catholic Identity at Mount St. Mary's University. Monsignor, good to have you with us.
It's good to be with you.
And Monsignor Charles Pope is with us. He's pastor of the Holy Comforter St. Cyprian Church, a vibrant parish community in Washington, D.C. Monsignor Pope, good to have you with us as well.
Good morning.
And he is, well, as a full disclosure, our dear friend and program director, Marcella Shepard, goes to the Monsignor's Church in Washington, which is how we found this Monsignor. And Mary Akron O'Neill is with us, a Sister of Mercy, founding director of the Mount St. Agnes Theological Center for Women, and one of the leading intellectuals and thinkers about where the church is going. Sister Mary Akron O'Neill, always great to have you with us. Welcome back.
Thanks, Mark.
How are you feeling?
I'm better, thank you.
Good. And you all can join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. You can log on to our Facebook pages, or you can tweet me at Mark Steiner. We really want to hear your thoughts. Baltimore is, along with New Orleans, one of the centers of black Catholicism. So this is a good city to talk about this in. And if you hear me say our once in a while, it's because my mother, who was raised in a convent in the Mountain of Wales by these crazed pro-IRA Irish nuns. So we...
Yeah. No, I never knew that.
You're in the family, yes.
So, right.
And incidentally, so, if I could interject, one of the more famous members of the St. Cyprian Church, Holy Comforter Church, was Camille Cosby. She grew up in that congregation.
Interesting.
I'm sure the Monsignor would agree. She went to that school years ago.
Yeah. Well, there you go. Thank you for that. Mm-hmm. So let's talk just about this in very general terms first. I mean, people didn't know what to expect from Pope Francis. People looked at his being put in place as a 76-year-old man, as almost like a caretaker from Italian descent from Argentina, was always associated with the conservative end of the church. But then he began doing these things from washing the feet and kissing the feet of Muslims and women to touching the heads of completely disfigured people, bringing people into the Vatican who were homeless to eat, calling up perfect strangers that he'd never heard of before and going, "Ciao, sono Papa Francesco," saying the Pope is calling them. I mean, so this is it's a figure that really has kind of confused people about where he is and what he's doing. So I'm very curious as to your analysis of all that. And let's start with our newest guest, if I might, Monsignor Pope.
Yes, well, I think certainly these are very dramatic gestures, although, I will say that, looking back, John Paul was certainly given to very dramatic gestures and things as well. Of course, being the first sort of non-Italian pope in a long time, he was, and he reached out so powerfully to young people, he began to get on planes and just travel everywhere. And so we've seen these in the past. So I think but I think probably the kind and number of things that the Pope has done is, in terms of dramatic gestures have moved many people. And it brings it to a special light. But in terms of fundamental doctrine and teaching, he's been careful to reiterate that these things change on a number of cases, in a number of instances. And so I think we need to hold all of them in balance and realize that dramatic though these gestures may seem, at the end of the day, I think the world does have to remember he's a Catholic pope, and he will hold Catholic teaching and has done so.
Well, Mary Ackland O'Neill, one thing struck me, and I'm just going to bring this issue up now while we're at the top of it. When I look at everything from what he has said about the poor, asking also Gustavo Gutierrez, the father of the liberation theology movement, to the Vatican almost immediately, asking the person who was silenced, Leonardo Boff, to contribute his writings to a new book that they're going to publish on planning on the environment. And kind of eco-revolutionary stuff. But he also has said things like, as Monsignor just said, women can and must be present in the places of decision-making in the church. He told someone in the church press. But he said, the door is closed, the ordination of women, and has ruled out female cardinals, saying women in the church must be valued, not clericized. So there's a breadth to this, Mary Ackland O'Neill.
Yes, there's a great breadth to it. When you invited me to be in on this conversation, I immediately thought of a line I had just reread from Thomas Merton, the Cistercian monk and author of many spiritual books. The day that he died, he had given a lecture, and someone complained that he didn't say anything in the lecture about converting people. So this was his response. I'm going to quote it exactly.
All right.
What we are asked to do at present is not so much to speak of Christ as to let him live in us so that people may find him by feeling how he lives in us, unquote.
Hmm.
And I really think that captures what Pope Francis is doing.
So tell me what you mean by that. Could explain that a little just for a moment, then we'll turn to other guests.
Well, you talked about the changes, and right. I agree. I think he's undergone significant change in his lifetime because he's been on a journey of continual conversion. And I believe that he's reached a point now in his maturity where he has so interiorized the ethos and the life and the spirit of the one whom he follows, that it is completely spontaneous. I mean, you never get a sense from him that he's consulting a manual or looking at a rule book.
Right.
Really, Or that he's even worried about what other people think of him. I mean, it seems to come from such a depth in him and to be so much a part of him that whatever he does is appropriate. Now, I'm not saying that he won't make missteps or that he hasn't made missteps, but for the most part, I think he's been so on target, and as a result, people are responding to him in a way that, is quite extraordinary.
And Ralph, when we saw this conversation back and forth on Rosemary Thompson's Facebook page, when she was announcing she was coming on the show, one of the things you said on the page was that you're gushing about this Pope.
Well, I like him. I think he probably is most informed by his experience of living in the heart of the city and living with poor people. And he's had theology. He's had great training. He's involved in politics and all that. But I think that's what comes home to him. And I think he has carried himself in such a way that he operates very simply. I think they wanted to carry his bags, and he on that first day, and he said, "No, I'll carry my own bags. I'll pay my own bill, and I'm not going to live in the palace. I'm going to live in this apartment here." And those made great statements for starters. And I like to say most of us would rather see a good sermon than hear one. And I think he's a good sermon. About the poor, and that I think he's shifting some accents, that the church can be noted for doing great charity historically and around the world, and the way he's talking, he's saying we can do charity, but we also must be about change. And so he talks about the trickle-down theory and how it's not been as nearly as effective as we've expected it to be, and he's talked about income inequality, and I haven't heard too many popes talk this way. And I've realized that this is the first pope I've heard And I can remember Pope Pius the 12th, I think it was, and all the succeeding popes, but this is the first one I've actually heard. And I knew I was hearing him doing the whole issue to the buildup in Syria and whether or not we were going to do a military action in Syria. And the way it was posed, it was not clear whether or not we should do it or not. But then, you know, they said, what about all those children that are being gassed and all that? And the Pope stepped up and said, violence is not the way to solve this kind of thing. And that drove me to go out and stand on the corner of Charles and University, my wife and I.
Stood there with you.
Yeah, right. protesting and letting the president know that there were citizens who were opposed to military action in Syria.
So let me just go on with kind of the specific topics and kind of bring them out and see what we think about all this and what it means for the church in the future. And go to Rosemary, then we'll go to Monsignor Svetland.
Well, you know, I guess what I was quoted as saying is that I wasn't gushy and starry-eyed about this.
That's
Pope.
What you said, yeah.
Right. And I think what I want to say is that I think that he has made wonderful gestures. And I agree with Ralph that September 7th, he asked the whole world to fast and to pray. And I think he did keep us from once again going into as a military intervention. Mm-hmm. But for me, the house is on fire and there's a child inside, and that's still happening. And I think that, you know, we need to go beyond the gestures to something very substantial. Monsignor mentioned the Catholic social teachings. One of the social teachings of the Catholic Church, the best kept secret in the pews, right, is that God has the preferential option for the poor. Do we believe that? And if we believe that, then how then do we live? And I think he has condemned capitalism, and I'm very impressed by that. But I still think that we can do better. And let's be honest, the bar has been kind of low lately. And, you know, I understand that it's a long road. And we start with gestures, and then we finally get to something very, very substantial. But I work with women who are housing people seeking asylum in this country, and they're living in convents. And I think that's the kind of thing that I want to hear the Pope say, is that open up the convents, open up the rectories, be bold, be brave. You know, I have friends who are in prison right now because they listened to the gospel, they believed in the biblical imperative to social change, and they took a risk. I'm not asking the Pope to go to jail, but I think that something parallel to that is possible for him.
Monsignor Svetland, let me pick up on that point. Excuse me.
Well, I agree with what we've heard before. It's an amazing agreement around. The tone has allowed, as Ralph said, a new tone, a new style for the teachings that have been there. After all, John Paul II said that we need a new liberation theology, and that theology, understood rightly, does liberate us on every level of our being, including economic. But he said that in such a way that it wasn't heard in Salici Tuus Rei Socialis, 1987. But Francis is saying in a way that is heard. What I like as someone who teaches seminary, is that he's challenging the clergy to get out in the street. Mm-hmm. You know, he wants a church that's more bloodied and beat up and dirty than pristine and perfect. And I think that tone is something that in our day and age our priests need to hear, because the temptation could always be to live as a comfortable middle-class existence in the rectory rather than getting out and engaging the people the way Christ did and the way Francis is trying to demonstrate with his goodness.
So let me – there are a couple of things I do want to tackle here. Some of the quotes he has said earlier and the kind of removing certain conservative cardinals from certain positions and putting in – cardinals from other countries that have never been there before, and also liberal cardinals. Come to that in a moment. But let me pick up with what I'll play a little bit with Monsignor Svetland just said for the next few minutes, and talk about liberation theology for a moment. I mean, this was a movement that came out of the Catholic Church in the 70s and 80s in Latin America, and Rome did try to eviscerate it, emasculate it, for want of a better term, and destroy it. And they silenced Leonardo da Vinci and wouldn't let him write anymore. It's called an obsequious silence. It was condemned as a Marxist, communist kind of movement. But the first thing this pope did was to bring Gustavo Gutiérrez to Rome. that really shocked a lot of people, because and also I've been reading that Bishop Romero, who was assassinated, who the process under the former Pope, even when he was cardinal, not to allow his canonization to proceed, that seems to be opening up. Mm-hmm. So what is this saying?
This is some area I do teach in liberation theology. I'll say Gutierrez, for example, the founder, Father Gutierrez, the founder of liberation theology, really, he accepted the criticisms of the 80s as very, very much accurate. And what's changed is liberation theology now has matured and has separated itself from more of the inappropriate philosophy that was incompatible with the gospel. It was borrowing too much from Marxism and was creating a theology that just didn't work, because Marxism is rooted in an atheistic philosophy and an atheistic view of the human person. What this Pope has been doing is engaging liberation theologians who have matured and recognize, you know, the wall came down. No one's really embracing Marxism as a workable philosophical system anymore. So the liberation theology we have today is different than what was being condemned in the mid-'80s.
Amen.
But let's push that a little further. I mean, I think you all should kind of jump in with your own thoughts about this, because this, I think, is a very serious issue, and especially building on Romero and others. And when the Pope was questioned, he said, you know, I may not be a Marxist, but some people I respect a great deal are Marxists. Some of my closest friends are Marxists.
Right.
So, he made that.
And he engaged atheists and said, you know.
You too can go to heaven.
You too can go to heaven.
Right, yes. It's been absolutely amazing. And I think when we look at the context of the politics of the time, the 80s, it was a very uptight time, I think. You know, we had an uptight president, in my view, for several of them. They weren't people-oriented. They weren't it wasn't about income equality and these kind of things. I don't know enough about the liberation theology. I've read a little bit in my time. I think this Pope represents an openness, a willingness to hear ideas and not be such a gotcha kind of a person. You don't follow my philosophy. You either follow it to the letter or get out.
We're going to take a short break here, but I'm going to come right back. I'm going to come right to Mary Akron O'Neill and Monsignor Pope for their look at this and look a little bit deeper into this and pick up some of the other things he's been doing and see what we think this means for the church and beyond. 410-319-8888 as we reflect on this first anniversary of Pope Francis being the leader of the Catholic Church. We're going out with Breaking Up Is Hard to Do by Neil Sedaka for this day in 1939.
Don't you leave my heart in misery. If you go, then
Song for Asada by Common. It's his birthday today. Of course, that was the song he wrote about Asada Shakur. We are here talking about Pope Francis and his first year. We are here with Ralph Moore, with Rosemary Thompson, Monsignor Stuart Sweatland from Mount St. Mary's, Monsignor Charles Pope from the Holy Comforter, St. Cyprian Church in Washington, D.C., and Mary Akron O'Neill, founder of the Mount St. Agnes Theological Center for Women. Mary Akron, let me ask you to come in next and go right to Monsignor Pope.
Sure. Mark, I think you gave us a good clue when you quoted that line about some of my best friends are Marxists. I think Francis begins with the person. Academics often begin with the idea. So, uh-huh. You know, liberation theology, the homosexual person, an abstraction. But I don't think Pope Francis begins there. I think he always begins with the person. And that makes a big difference, because with the person, you have a context, you have a history, you have a name. You have a body, you have a concreteness. And so for him, I mean, the other thing is, of course, he lived in the area where liberation theology was being developed and maturing, as the previous speaker said. So he knows how it looks on the ground and not how it looks in books. And I think he's bringing that knowledge and that respect for it to the universal church.
Monsignor Pope?
Yeah, I think that's a very good insight, to begin with the person. And I know Monsignor Sweatland and I, you know, as priests often, we hold a powerful doctrine, a set of scriptures and doctrine, and yet we also have to engage everyone as individuals and try to listen to them and bring these two remarkable things together, the remarkable individual we're dealing with, as well as a rich tradition of 2,000 years of thinking and reflecting on God's Word. Catholicism is very hard to just boil down to very simple things. When you've got 2,000 years of doctrine, tradition, and then all the years of Scripture, even going before Christ came in the Hebrew Scriptures and so on, all of these are remarkable things that we all have to hold in balance. So Catholicism is always going to be a matter of some emphasis, trying to bring the individual to a magnificent doctrine and set of teachings, but always respectful of the individual. And we make these walks both with communities, with individuals, and we engage the world. And, of course, the Pope is going to be doing all of that. And I think that's a good insight, that he is very good at beginning with the individual. Where are they? And what is good here? Where do we begin this conversation? You know, that old saying, even a broken clock is right twice a day. So even if there is a person in great disrepair and we're having great struggles, we try to find where can we begin this discussion with an individual? Well, you know, what's going on in their life? Where do we agree? Where can we sit down and begin the conversation? This is always going to be the genius of a pastor.
Mm-hmm. Well, the Pope has called on the church to be more of a field hospital, and I think that's a great image.
Yeah,
really. But it's also interesting when you all were talking about the efforts to dismantle liberation theology. My thought went to how there seems to be a movement in this country to dismantle the war on poverty, and being led by Catholics. Paul Ryan is in the news. He wants to take free lunches from kids and all sorts of things. John Boehner won't bring up the vote to extend unemployment benefits. These are prominent Catholics who are doing some pretty evil things, which are at the very least inconsistent from the message we've gotten over the last year. So this whole movement to dismantle has its face and its place in a number of different locations now. And I think this Pope is calling upon members of the church to fight it. To be courageous, and to deal with it, and to defend those who can't so easily defend themselves.
Well, and who is this?
I think that's very well said. That idea of a person-centered ethic, mm-hmm, on economics. I was looking at an essay yesterday. Was a speech he gave to diplomats. He has all these diplomats gathered, and he says to them, money has to serve, not rule. The Pope loves everyone, rich and poor alike, but the Pope has the duty in Christ's name to remind the rich, to help the poor, to respect them, to promote them. The Pope appeals for disinterested solidarity and for a return to person-centered ethics in the world of finance and economics. I mean, that's, you know, he speaks truth to power that way. You know, this is the most formal of occasions, the gathering of diplomats. But he challenges them to have a person-centered economic system.
I mean, I'm curious about our listeners thing as well, 403-19-8888. But what do you think it will do to the conversation about the social future, the political future of our country and world? Because the every institution, the institutions on the scale of a Catholic Church, have huge influence on where the world goes, because they influence people's thinking, and the Catholic thinking on the planet, which influences other thinking, because the Catholic presence is huge on the planet Earth, right? So when you have a Pope that talks about let's not kind of obsess on abortion, let's not keep talking about what happens to gay people, even to the point of saying that it almost felt like he was saying that civil marriages outside the church, we don't care. That's not something we need to fight about. What we need to worry about is the poor. But that's also a very political statement, because I heard what you said, Monsignor, but in some senses, reading what the Pope said, it's more than just a question of serving the poor. It's a question of liberating the poor from poverty that he's talking about, and walking among and in. And you're seeing that here in this world, in this country, in the city of Baltimore where we're talking from. I mean, you've had these shows in the last few days on public housing for the poor. Mm-hmm. In Baltimore, we have 89,000 people who live in the city that are home insecure, and nobody's addressing that. If you don't start dealing with that, what kind of society do we have? So I'm curious what we all think that what effect do you think this Pope will have on that consciousness, if any? Rosemary.
So I think the consciousness, for me, it comes down to the difference between the word charity and the word restorative justice. So charity is, I'm going to help somebody who needs help. Restorative justice says that coat, that poor person standing on the street corner without a coat, homeless, had that coat stolen from them. They had a right as a human being to have essentials. And I think my hope and prayer is that this Pope has gone through so many conversions in his life, his time in Argentina, the dirty war, his influence with the Jesuits there. I think he was I think he had a complete conversion. And I think the other day when he Italy, there was somebody did some graffiti and called him a superstar. And he came out to say, I am not a superstar. I'm a sinner. And the story he told, which I thought was just really compelling, is that he said that one of his mentors died, this dramatically wonderful priest. And he said as they were lowering the coffin on this priest, he reached in and stole the crucifix off the rosary. And he said it was an act of theft, but that he wanted people to know that he was fully human and he's not perfect and he is a sinner. And I come to you as a sinner. When the Pope was supposed to give the original blessing, he didn't do that. He said, please pray for me. I'm encouraged by that.
Sister Mary Akronin, I want to jump in and also Father Pope, your thoughts on this and what it says about the social justice.
Well, I think the previous speaker is absolutely right about the fact that prominent Catholics are making their own choices about what they accept from this Pope. That's been true for a long time on the economy. The very people who will accuse liberal Catholics of being cafeteria Catholics and picking and choosing will do that when it comes to the economy, because their axe is going to be, bull is going to be gored, or whatever the expression
is.
Ox is going to be gored. Thank you.
Some animal.
Yeah. Right. What's ironic to me is that the Pope is touching the nerve of many Protestants, mm-hmm. and even, sort of fundamentalist evangelicals are now quoting the Pope. There are Protestant members of Congress and the Senate that are quoting the Pope. So his style of Christianity, I think, is speaking way beyond Catholicism and the resistance that we've gotten to it, or so it seems, on the part of some prominent Catholics, is being more than made up for by the fact that his voice is being heard way beyond, as I say, Catholicism.
Monsignor Pope?
Yes, mm-hmm. I would also like to say, perhaps just to pull a little in the other direction, and that is to say that we're here just a year out from his beginning, and he set very big themes, and I think he's done a lot. One of the dangers, I think, to avoid is that he's spoken in very general ways, and he's made some specific remarks, but an awful lot of people from very different realms are kind of owning the Pope as their own and saying, see, he's my guy. And I think that as we move forward, I think we do have to accept the fact that just as Jesus could at one moment speak in a way that pleased people and then turn on a dime and really startle them. And I think that the office of a true prophet is going to be that none of us should be comfortable in the presence of a prophet, and yet also none of us, all of us will also find consolation and encouragement from the Word of God. So we have to, I think, be open to being both challenged by the Pope and or any prophet, and likewise also be open to being consoled. And I think at some level, as we move forward, we're all going to experience both challenge and consolation.
We should not let the prophets be comfortable in our presence either, I think.
Amen.
And I remember circulating a petition around the time that Nelson Mandela died and was buried on Change.org, which I was trying to hope would get to the Pope, urging that the Pope canonize Nelson Mandela. He's not a Catholic.
Even though he's not Catholic.
It'd be nice to get a few non-Catholics in heaven. and all. And I know that there aren't a whole lot of African-Americans in heaven, and people who were born Catholic and have been Catholic all their lives. I hope this Pope will canonize Mother Mary Lang, the founder of the Oblate Sisters of Providence, for example. Now, what's that going to do to the income inequality situation? Maybe it'll have an impact or not. But I'm just saying that the whole change in tone is what I'm looking for. I was surprised a few months ago when they circulated a survey in church. Do you all remember that?
Yes.
Yeah.
Because for the first time in my life, and again, I'm 61 years old, but I've been a Catholic all those years, they were asking our opinion. I don't know what they're going to do with it, but this has not been anything nearly resembling a democracy. And even worse than that, they didn't care what we thought. But I filled out that survey online and sent it in, and I haven't heard anything. Now, I think they're supposed to be for some kind of a conclave in October.
That's right.
Or something. But nonetheless, just that process under this Pope is very, very different from my experience.
And I think that brings us to another very important point about Pope Francis's way of governing. Not only has he consulted the faithful, but at the most recent consistory, when the cardinals were gathered before the time when some of them were elevated, he had meetings with them at which they not only spoke their minds freely, but sometimes, sometimes they said things that disagreed with him, right in front of him. And he not only allows this, he encourages it. So rather than having meetings where there's a discussion, but then in the end everything has to be rubber stamped and what comes out is what he wants, I fully expect that we're going to see out of the next synod a very, very different report and a very different reflection of the church.
So the thing that grabbed the world first, we touched around the edges in this, but I just want to throw it out here. And it's what I think one of the first things that hit the world was when the Pope made this statement. He said, "If someone is gay and he searches for the Lord and has goodwill, who am I to judge?" And then he said that he reiterated. The church stance that marriage is between a man and a woman, and added that the church needs to look, he said, at the issue of civil unions to protect the civil and legal rights of quote unquote diverse situations of cohabitation. So I mean, that when he did that, I mean that was what shocked a lot of people. That he was people did not expect it. That was almost in some ways, especially for most non-Catholics, that was this first giant salvo people recognized from the Pope, though he'd been doing other stuff before that and has since. But that's pretty profound. I'm curious how we reflect on what that means and the mass movement to stop gay marriage that the Catholic Church was a big part of, and the official church was, to not let that pass. And what this says to us all. Let me start with our two Monsignors. Monsignor Pope, why don't you jump in first?
Well, I want to say that when the Pope speaks in these ways, we have to, I think, accept the fact, though, that he's not claiming that we're going to change church or scriptural teaching on these matters.
No, he didn't say that. No, right.
And I think that we have to remember it that way. So when he says, "Who am I to judge?" He's holding equal the fact. Listen, in my parish there are certainly gay Catholics, and many, if not most of them, are living celibately, and they're to be confirmed and appreciated. We don't reject in the Catholic Church anyone for their orientation. We simply summon everyone, whether gay or heterosexual or married, to live in conformity to the state of their life and apply what is, you know, sexuality in terms of that. So everyone who's single, gay or straight, are called to live celibately and properly, and those who are married to remain absolutely faithful to their spouse in both behavior and in heart. And that's the summons of Scripture. And this is not going to change in the church, but we want to therefore be open, though, to explain that to everyone. We all come before God as sinners. There are struggles that people have in regards to sexuality and any number of other issues. We're running a hospital, as someone has already pointed out, and we invite people who are struggling to come, but to receive then the medicine of God's word and the medicine of church teaching. an encouragement to try to live in accord with God's will. And that's where we stand as a church, welcoming, but also saying, here is the medicine that God offers us.
But again, we'll go to Monsignor Swetland and go back to the entire panel to comment on this. But I was just saying again, he said, and I don't have the entire quote in front of me, but part of his quote was diverse situations of cohabitation, where he was talking and said the church has to look at the issue of civil unions to protect the civil and legal rights of diverse situations of cohabitation, which takes it a bit beyond the question of people who are gay and not celibate. He's talking about people who are not celibate, engaged in active gay relationships, men and women, that we have to look at this. Not saying he has to, the church is going to change and go, okay, we support gay marriage, but that to me was a huge social leap. What, Monsignor Swetland? Then we'll go around the room.
Right. Well, you see him doing this, proposing this when he was the Archbishop in Argentina, too, and this issue was being debated. But what I see in this is something we haven't touched on. It's the same modus operandi that he's going into how he's reforming the Curia in Rome, which perhaps will be his most lasting impact.
Which he's doing, yes, right, right.
Yeah, with the same approach. Let's dive in and see what works, and nothing's off the table. I mean, he's already restructured in very significant ways and really is changing the mindset of the Curia in Rome. That may be his hardest thing to tackle, to be honest with you. And No,
after 2,000 years, of course it is.
And he's going in with saying, you know, let's really try to dive in and see what works. And he's going to be, in that sense, more experimental than perhaps Pontiffs have been in the past.
May I, Quinn?
Well, you know, I said before he has the approach through the person, which I think is germane here. But he also thinks in images. And so I think, you know, the image of the field hospital that's already been referenced, and also the other image, which I love, which is that the bishops should smell of their sheep. Those two images are very important to understand his approach, I think. And so if you sit in your study and you think about these issues, let's say same-sex marriage or cohabitation, you can come up with a very perfect world. But when you're in the field hospital or when you're out with your sheep and you see the complexity of people's lives, it's a very, very different picture. And I think he's trying to walk that tightrope between the doctrine of the church, which is really based on the ideal, and the realities of people's lives, which he knows very well. One story I read was of a priest who had flown to Buenos Aires, and the bishop picked him up and drove him to all the places where poor people lived, and the favelas and the barrios, and showed him the places where misery and poverty rule. He didn't take him to see the beautiful palaces. And I think that's so instructive because those are the places that Pope Francis knew. In fact, that's where he ministered regularly and continues even as Pope to try his best to minister. So he knows how hard it is for people in their real lives to follow the ideal ideals that the church puts forth. And so I think he's trying to make an opening for changes that will accommodate somehow the gap between reality and the ideal.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, my hope and dream is that one day the church gets out of the bedroom. The God of my understanding, the way I follow Christ, leads me to bigger issues and more important declarations of the value of human life and the ability to love one another on some real level. And so I'm touched very much by the Pope attempting to do all that. But I think the significant things he's done so far is he closed 9 corrupted accounts at the Vatican. Mm-hmm. He identified 19 poor people to become cardinals. These are the things that matter. And I think that's just my hope and dream, is that we stop obsessing about the bedroom and start obsessing about the inequality in the world.
So, yes, but he called the first synod on the family, so he clearly has a deep. I mean, we can label them bedroom issues, but they're issues of life and issues about the future of humanity. And I think if you think about it in a larger context, then you'll understand why for him the family is central and so important that his very first synod is going to concentrate on that.
But I think what we have learned over the years is that the so-called traditional definition of a family no longer holds. There are all sorts of families. I think Mrs. Doubtfire talked about that in the film. But I guess what I find hopeful in his statement is, again, the tone, among other things, that I know lesbian and gay people who are absolutely turned off and insulted by statements that they and actions that they feel from the Catholic Church. That in our own recent experience here in Maryland, when question six was on the ballot, the Catholics aligned themselves with some people who were saying some very ugly and mean things about people who were gay and lesbian. And I was very disappointed by that. I was very disappointed that one of the high church officials spent $2,000 of his own money to try to defeat question six. How many people could we have fed with that? How many people could we have clothed with that? So, but the righteous gotcha game kind of attitude for people that we think ought to be in this standard traditional view of life is what is very, very difficult to me. It's very ugly. And in fact, it comes across as mean. And I'm not sure that's where the church ought to be evidencing itself.
There's a question that we didn't get into. Maybe we'll do this another day. But I think that it's important to raise as well, which is a tough one to wrestle with. Was the first comment he made, the comments he made in an interview about clerical sexual abuse. That came since the February report from the United Nations that was really withering against the church and covering things up. People were kind of looking for Pope Francis, after everything else, to kind of really wrestle with this in a deeper way. Do you think we'll see that? We haven't seen it yet.
Well, you know, I talked about missteps. I really thought one of his missteps was the statement that he made in this most recent interview, talking about the church being transparent and having done more than any other institution and being under attack. And I mean, it was so surprising to me. And it seemed out of character, to tell you the truth, because he seems rather defensive of the church on that score. I just wish that he had been quiet on that, because I think we have such a black eye where the abuse of children is concerned, and it's going to be a very long time for us to recover from this. And so defensive statements, I think, are not helpful at this point.
I'd also like to add, as Monsignor Pope was talking, I would like to add, though, that I think that I don't know that it's fair to simply label principled concerns about marriage and family, which we take from the scriptures that we hold very sacred, as just being mean or so on. And I don't think that the comment was intended to do that, but I would like to at least push back a little and say that politics does get ugly, and it gets messy when you go out there in the public square, and sometimes people join up with you that, you know, you don't share a lot with, but they agree with you on the one issue. So let's just all admit that on both sides of that equation, politics can get pretty ugly, but I would just like to say that I think that as a Catholic who believes very wholeheartedly in the biblical vision of human sexuality, that I'm trying to draw people to a vision that is ultimately for our health and for our well-being, for our goodness. And I do know, and I deal with people every day who are struggling in this area and in other areas as well, about forgiveness, about mercy, about loving their enemy, and so on. And at some level, we do have to say things that are at times hard. But we say them like a doctor who says it's time to lose a little weight, or we say them in a way that comes from a position of love. And I don't know that when the world moves away from the biblical vision, that remains, that those of us who remain with it are therefore engaging in hateful or bigoted thinking. We're trying to bring people to a vision that ultimately we believe is for their good and for our good as a culture. That's my hope, that people will understand where the church is coming from.
We're almost out of time here. I wish we could go do more. We had an interesting email just came in from saying, would it be fair to say that what Pope Francis is doing on a global scale is analogous to the behavior of Bishop Marial and Victor Hugo's Les Miserables, where the Pope there gave, where the Cardinal gave away his mansion, saying we have to give it to the poor and open it as a hospital. He wrote a very long email here. I wish I could got into it earlier. I just saw it. It's very interesting, and maybe we could tackle this and some other stuff on another day. I appreciate the email, Hayden. I wish we could have gotten into it earlier. But I do want to thank all of our guests. It's been fascinating. You just heard Monsignor Charles Pope, pastor of the Holy Comforter St. Cyprian Church, a vibrant parish community in Washington, D.C., Monsignor Stuart Swetland, vice president for Catholic Identity at St. Mary's University, Sister Mary Aquin O'Neill of Sisters of Mercy, founding director of the Mount St. Agnes Theological Center for Women, Rosemary Thompson, who's executive director of the P. Francis Murphy Initiative for Justice and Peace and has been deeply involved in the peace movement in the Catholic Church her entire life, from the Barragans on in the 60s on. Ralph Moore, community organizer who's been deeply involved in the Catholic Church work and in Catholic education, is now coordinator of mentoring for Adult Resource Center of the Living Classrooms Foundation, where he works with adult male ex-offenders. Thank all of you for joining us. It's been a fascinating discussion. I appreciate you taking your time with our listeners.
Thanks, Mark.
Thank you, Mark. Bye-bye.
And we are going to go out on this break with Yakety Yak by the Coasters, co-written by Mike Stoller, born on this day in 1923. Songwriter and producer for Elvis Presley, Buddy Holly, the Monkees, the Cliff Richard. Yakety Yak, the Coasters. We'll be right back as we meet some students taking on what they think is unfair testing with their poetry. Stay with us.
Just finished cleaning up your room.